You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello everyone and welcome to History of the Great War Revisited Episode 4, The Anglo-German Naval Arms Race, Fisher's Reforms. Last episode we discussed the challenges faced by the Royal Navy during the 19th century. Most of those challenges revolved around how to adapt to the new technologies and the ever-shifting geopolitical situation. This episode we will continue with the massive reforms that were put in place during the reign of Admiral Sir John Fisher as First Sea Lord, starting in 1905. It would be under Fisher's leadership that the Royal Navy, as it would be in 1914, would be created. Fisher's reforms would drastically change both the Royal Navy and then every other navy in the world due to their reaction to those changes. The most well-known of these changes would be the creation of the HMS Dreadnought, which was, of course, a very big deal. But many of Fisher's reforms were far less flashy, and often more controversial, but just as impactful. Among these less flashy changes were his attempts to address the economic problems that the Royal Navy was facing, his efforts to change how the Royal Navy treated its most technical officers, and a shift in where the power of the Royal Navy was positioned around the globe in peacetime. To try and attack the budgetary problems of the Royal Navy, he targeted older ships that the Royal Navy had been holding on to for many years. He believed that there were too many ships, and many of them hopelessly obsolete, scattered around the world that existed purely to show the flag of the Royal Navy, which was all well and good, albeit expensive during the time of peace, but it would make the Navy less prepared for a period of war. A good way to describe the Fisher-era reforms, and the reason that they were needed, comes from Fisher himself, who would say, quote, "There is only so much money available to the Navy. If you put it into chairs that can't fight, you take it away from the ships and men who can." End quote. The removal of these ships from the Navy was just one of his many reforms. The rapid pace of technological change also required an important rethinking of how technical engineers were treated in the Royal Navy. For decades, there had been a set of officers that were looked down upon by the more traditionally trained naval officers, mostly around the engineering fields. This would change, and engineering officers would be given the same powers and privileges of the executive officers, making engineering a more attractive specialty for a new generation of Royal Navy officers who were coming on board. Fisher would also reposition the strength of the Royal Navy around the globe, recognizing that the demands being placed upon the fleets were different than they had been in previous generations, and this meant that the Royal Navy needed its strength in different areas around the globe to meet those challenges. In their book, The Rules of the Game, Jutland and the British Naval Command, Andrew Gordon and Paul Wilderson have this excellent piece of info to emphasize the pace and scale of change during Fisher's time in the Royal Navy that began in 1854. Fisher would be a part of a unique generation of naval leaders who had started their career in the age of sail and would live to see the massive dreadnoughts of the First World War. As Gordon and Wilderson would say, quote, "He was nominated for the Navy in 1854 by the last of Nelson's captains still on the active list, and the last of the great ships he built, the HMS Renown, was in frontline service in the year of the atomic bomb." That's amazing that he came in so close, I guess, relatively, to the age of Nelson, and he okayed or he accepted the design of the HMS Renown, which was still in service in 1945. The rate of technological change in the Navy during this period was surpass anything from the previous centuries, and Fisher would be the one to try and force the Royal Navy to adapt. Fisher's path to effecting change would start in the Mediterranean when he took command of the fleet in that sea in 1899. He would be in command in the Mediterranean for 3 years, and during this time he was focused on one thing, preparing the fleet for war. His reformist tendencies were present right from the very moment that he took over command, and would be showcased in his very first act as fleet commander. The tradition among the fleet was that when a new commander arrived, each captain of the ships of the fleet would visit the flagship individually. Then the fleet commander would visit that captain's ship individually before meeting with the next captain on the flagship. Instead of this process, which could take days, even weeks, Fisher just invited all the captains to his flagship, had a single meeting, and then he was done with it, so he could get to work. One of the forward-looking changes that he would introduce would be the introduction of an emphasis on long-range gunnery practice. Often, gunnery practice was done at very short range and against stationary or slowly towed targets. Fisher would change this, pushing the range out to 6,000 yards, which at the time was an extremely long distance. This drastically cut the success rate of the firing, but Fisher believed that it presented a far more realistic battle scenario. Wartime experience would prove that this theory was absolutely correct, and very often ships would engage one another at the maximum possible distance, making long-distance gunnery practice essential. He would also follow in the footsteps of Tryon, which we talked about last episode, in his disdain for many of the changes that had been made in the Royal Navy in the preceding years. Fisher believed that the most important thing that could be done during peacetime was accurately preparing for war. Instead, so much of the time of the captains and crews of the Royal Navy were spent on making things look good, or on exercises that were not under realistic conditions. Fisher would change this. These changes would cause friction with many other naval leaders at the time, but Fisher had a group of generally younger officers under his command that strongly supported his ideas. After 3 years as the head of the Mediterranean Fleet, Fisher would go back to London and take up the post of Second Sea Lord. And during his year in this position, his ideas and plans for his sort of leadership reforms that would follow began to solidify. One of these ideas would become the HMS Dreadnought and the battlecruisers that would battle alongside it. The concept of these new classes of ships would then be detailed during Fisher's stint as the commander-in-chief at Portsmouth. All of these actions and postings were leading up to his time as the First Sea Lord, a position that he would assume on October 21st, 1904. Before we discuss what Fisher would be doing during his time as First Sea Lord, we have to talk just briefly about an event that occurred less than a day after he took over the position. This would be an event that would almost lead the Royal Navy to start a war with Russia. The Russo-Japanese War was ongoing, and the Russian Pacific Fleet was destroyed. The Russians believed that their only option to continue the war was to send their Baltic fleet all the way around the world to take its place. This was a very bad decision, for enough reasons that it would take a whole episode to describe them, but trust me, it was a very bad call. Part of this journey meant sailing through the North Sea. The Russians were very concerned that there might be Japanese torpedo boats in these waters, which would be present with the knowledge and permission of the Royal Navy if they were there. These concerns were so acute that when some spotlights found some ships near Dogger Bank, the Russian ships opened fire. They were in fact not Japanese torpedo boats, but instead British fishing ships. This almost caused an international incident just a few hours after Fisher took over the Navy. Now, nothing would come of this tension other than the destruction of the Russian Baltic Fleet as soon as they arrived in the Pacific, but that had nothing to do with the Royal Navy. The total destruction of the Russian fleet did represent a major shift in sort of naval geography, with Russia seen as one of the major possible enemies of the Royal Navy, especially at this point in history when there was a lot of tension between the Russian Empire and the British Empire and Asia, specifically kind of the approaches in Central Asia that connected with India. With the removal of the Russian fleet, the number of possible enemies for the Royal Navy was reduced, and Germany began to grow in focus. A focus that would play a role in many of Fisher's decisions. This shift was only amplified by the continued good relations with France, which would feature heavily in British foreign policy during the first 10 years of the 1900s. France had the second largest fleet in the world, and its large colonial empire made it a traditional rival of the British. With the improvements in relation between the two empires, even more focus could be applied on Germany. Fisher's years as First Sea Lord would see a large list of reforms, but in this episode we will be covering three of Fisher's main reforms: his changes to the personnel in the Navy, the changes to the policies around the retention and upkeep of older ships, and the strategic positioning of the Navy's resources. One reform that we will not discuss during this episode was the design and construction of the HMS Dreadnought. That deserves a lengthier discussion, which will occur next episode. If Fisher wanted to enact wide-ranging reforms, though, He believed that it was essential that he not only address the ships in the Royal Navy, but also the men aboard those ships. It would all start with the officers, which Fisher tried to address by reforming officer training. Some of the changes in this area would begin when Fisher was still the Second Sea Lord under Admiral Selborne. During his tenure as Second Sea Lord, Fisher would be given the task of working on what would come to be referred to as the engineer question, or the problem with the increased emphasis on engineering on naval vessels that was only getting more and more complicated. The problem was simply that the training structure of the Royal Navy did not prepare officers properly to understand the ships that they were in command of. And so a new system of training was introduced for all new officers in an attempt to create officers that were more prepared for the realities of modern naval operations. This meant studies on new technologies like steam engines and radios and long-range gunnery. Every officer was not expected to be an expert on all of these systems, but it was essential that they have at least some passing level of familiarity with all of the important systems on the ship. Along with this more basic training, there would be a new emphasis on continuing education. This involved topics like naval history, strategy, tactics, and international law. All of the things that officers needed, not just so that they knew how to do their job, but also to make the correct decisions while at sea. While this increased emphasis on training was a good idea and would make the officers better at leading their ships, it could not completely solve the problem around specifically engineers. When the first Royal Navy ships had received their steam engines, experts on steam engines had been recruited to work on them aboard ship. Then, as more and more technology was brought on board and the overall care and maintenance of the ship got more complicated, there were more engineers on board to keep things going. The problem was that engineering officers were not treated the same as other non-engineering officers, and there was a real limit on how far an engineering officer could go in the Navy, even though engineering skill and knowledge were more important than ever. The changes that would be put in place during Fisher's years of leadership would see this change with a separate track of promotion for engineering officers, but with each rank being equal to that of non-engineering officers as well. This meant that those engineers could eventually rise to quite high ranks, which was kind of really good when you think about it from like an engineering individual career prospect, because it helped the Navy retain the most talented engineers, which previously might leave the Navy to go into private industry because things were just better there. Some of the old school executive officers were not big fans of this change, but they mostly just saw it as an attack on their privilege and prestige, which Fisher, of all the things he cared about, he probably cared about that some of the least. Along with an emphasis on the training of officers for their current jobs and responsibilities, Fisher also supported innovators who wanted to improve the ability of those officers on board the ships to actually lead those ships in combat. One example of this was Captain Percy Scott, who was supported by Fisher in his attempts to increase the accuracy of the guns aboard the ships. Up until this point, the guns on the ships had often been using very rudimentary gunnery methods, often involving a lot of missing and then slow adjustments. Scott developed a system that almost tripled the accuracy of the guns and even had ways to account for the ever-present roll of the ship. Now, the topic of gun laying, range finding, and actually hitting targets that were thousands of meters distant will be the focus of episode 9 in this series, but I just wanted to bring that up as an example of how innovation was supported during Fisher's tenure, because such problems were investigated and real progress would be made to solving them, and they were all quite important. With all of these changes, Fisher was trying to prepare the Royal Navy not just to be a navy, but also to fight. Admiral Sir Sidney Freemantle would describe Fisher's actions like this, quote, "His great claim to fame is that he succeeded in making us think. Before he asserted himself, the spirit and discipline of the Navy were excellent, but we were in a groove in which merit was decided and rewards given for smartness in drills, in appearance of ships, and in handling them in close order. Fisher got us out of that groove and made us realize that the object of our existence was fighting, and that our training, our habits, our exercises, and our thoughts must always have that in view." In some ways, that quote and the way that Fisher is described reminds me of what Admiral Tryon might have been able to accomplish had he not been killed during the accident aboard the Victoria. While the officers were the primary focus of many of these changes, there was also an effort to make time for, you know, the sailors aboard the ship, and to make their time aboard the ship less horrible. Fisher would enact several long overdue reforms to life aboard ship that were almost universally welcomed by those on the lower decks. Many of these were easy changes, like making sure that there were bakeries on all ships so that nobody had to eat hardtack, improving the overall quality of the food, and then providing paths for career advancement for the men. These were items that today would be considered the bare minimum, and by instituting them, Fisher became very well liked among the sailors of the fleet. Along with improving the skills and knowledge of the officers, Fisher also wanted to better utilize the talent that the Navy did have, while also utilizing them in an economic way. This was done through the introduction of the Nucleus Crew System. Before the introduction of this system, the Royal Navy had an active fleet and a fleet reserve. These reserve ships, or at least the lowest level of reserve ships, were kept far from fighting shape, with the most skeleton of skeleton crews tasked with keeping them afloat while they were in long-term storage. It was understood that the schedule to get these ships ready to fight was probably measured in months, and so they would only be activated in case of a major war. Fisher's Nucleus Crew System tried to make the reserve fleet more than just a bunch of rusty hulls setting in harbor. Instead of being far from ready to fight, the fleet reserve would instead be manned by a Nucleus Crew, which would be about 2/5 of the ship's full complement. Importantly, this Nucleus Crew included all of the specialty officers, the ones whose knowledge was absolutely critical to ensuring that the ship was ready to sail. If the fleet was mobilized, these Nucleus Crews would then be augmented by reserve and trainee sailors, but because all of the most important men were already aboard the ships, the new sailors did not need extensive training. Fisher also mandated that these reserve ships participate in annual maneuvers, which gave both the ships and the men a chance to shake off the rust for new trainees to get a bit of on-the-job training. This was a complete shift in how the ships of the reserve fleet were viewed, and made them far more capable of being used in a wartime scenario and more capable when they were called upon. Fisher believed that this change, the Nucleus Crew System, was the most important of his changes, but there was a problem. The men did not exist within the Navy to create these Nucleus Crews, and Fisher could not expand the naval budget just to accommodate them. Fisher did have a plan for this problem, though, because another reform that went hand in hand with the Nucleus Crew System was the absolute brutal culling of the Royal Navy's ships.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24/7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Napoleon Bonaparte rose from obscurity to become the most powerful and significant figure in modern history. Over 200 years after his death, people are still debating his legacy. He was a man of contradictions, a tyrant and a reformer, a liberator and an oppressor, a revolutionary and a reactionary. His biography reads like a novel, and his influence is almost beyond measure. I'm Everett Rummage, host of the Age of Napoleon podcast, and every month I delve into the turbulent life and times of one of the greatest characters in history, and explore the world that shaped him in all its glory and tragedy. It's a story of great battles and campaigns, political intrigue, and massive social and economic change. But it's also a story about people, populated with remarkable characters. I hope you'll join me as I examine this fascinating era of history. Find The Age of Napoleon wherever you get your podcasts.
The brutal culling of these ships was required by the pace of technological advancements in the last two decades of the 19th century, although the Royal Navy was kind of in denial about the need for drastic changes. Since the Napoleonic War and into the modern day, naval technology has at times been cyclical, because there have been periods of very rapid technological change, like the beginning of the 20th century or before the Second World War, and then there have been long periods of relative stagnation, like the decades after the Napoleonic Wars or the years after the Second World War. For example, by the time of Trafalgar, Nelson's flagship was 40 years old, and at that point, there was not much difference between his ship and new ones coming out of port. This level of longevity would not be possible during the middle decades of the 19th century, due to the pace of technological change. However, these advancements would then slow before the 1880s. At a time when all ships were steam-powered and had armor plating, there were not a lot of game-changing sort of advancements that were being made. For the Royal Navy, these periods of slow technological change were a welcome development because the Navy had a large number of ships spread around the globe, and the slower technology changed, the longer those ships could be kept in service. This was particularly true for older cruisers that were used for trade defense, which would be generally categorized by the Navy as second or third class cruisers. For large fleet actions, these ships were totally worthless. However, they were thought to be valuable for two reasons. The first was the simple fact that it allowed the Royal Navy to show the flag all over the world. This was mostly a political function, but did serve to provide an ever-present reminder that the Royal Navy was present to protect British commerce. The second reason was that it was believed that other nations, like the French or the Russians, would use similar ships against British merchant ships around the world. So second or third class cruisers could meet second or third class cruisers of other nations in combat and maybe be okay. Fisher attacked both of these reasons in his quest to purge the naval roles of the older ships. From a military perspective, he believed that they were basically worthless. They could not fight ships larger or newer than themselves, and Fisher believed that they would not be called upon to fight older ships like they themselves were, but instead newer and faster ships of other navies. These ships, these newer ships, would completely destroy the older ships that the British were using. Here is Fisher's evaluation in his own words. Quote, "The most demoralizing and expensive and inefficient thing in the British Navy is the mass of small, isolated vessels which are known as the snail and tortoise classes, which can neither fight nor run away. The chief calamity is the deterioration of the men who serve in them, and the frightful anxiety of every admiral to get them hauled up on a beach or sunk before the enemy take them." End quote. From the political show-the-flag perspective, well, Fisher believed that the entire concept was based on a false premise, and that nobody would miss the ships once they were gone. Again, I'm going to use his own words here, quote, "Out of the 193 ships at present in commission, organized in fleet, 63 only are of such caliber as not to cause an admiral grave concern if allowed to wander from the protection of larger ships. There are among these several ships which should be paid off as soon as possible, being absolutely of no fighting value. Of course, objections will be raised, and it will be shown that the Navy cannot run without them, but wipe them out and in a year no one will remember that they ever existed." End quote. To get some idea of what needed to happen, each ship was given one of four grades, and I want to emphasize here that I'm using Fisher's words here. The grades were A, being prime fighting ships, B, being ships of doubtful value, C, being ships that were utterly useless for fighting purposes, and D, for ships that were absolutely obsolete. These grades provided a framework for the ships that could be stricken from the lists and offered up for scrap. While Fisher was concerned about the fighting capabilities of these ships, his primary concern actually wasn't that, but was instead around how much they were costing the Navy every single year. Even one of the smallest ships on station around the world cost £12,000 per year in maintenance. Larger ships, like some of the old and obsolete battleships, were upwards of £100,000. That's just the cost of keeping the ship afloat and mobile, and it did not account for the cost of the crews. Fisher wanted to get rid of all of them to free up money and men for his nucleus crew system. The total number of ships that he submitted to be scrapped were 154. And while this entire list was not immediately accepted, a very large percentage of them were. This included many smaller ships, but also much larger ships, like those of the Nile-class battleships that had been launched in 1887. Many of these ships were old and slow, and also some of them were just bad ships. During the previous decades of technological change, not every single concept and theory that the Royal Navy came up with was a winner. And there were many ships that were built on these theories that were found to be just bad naval vessels, for one reason or another. Often these ships were kept in the reserve fleet, eating away at the budget while providing very little real value. While the overseas squadrons were the hardest hit in Fisher's kind of culling, many of the ships were also struck in Dockyard Reserve and the Home Isles. These ships were theoretically available for activation for defense, but Fisher considered them to be worse than useless. Along with the removal of the ships from the lists, this action freed up 950 officers and 11,000 men, all of which were then available for the manning of new and more capable ships and could be used in the nucleus crew system. There were, of course, many men who did not feel that scrapping all these ships was the correct move. They all seemed to use roughly the same four arguments to try and make their case as for why. The first reason revolved around British prestige around the world, with the older ships being used for police actions, and removing them was felt to be a blow to the Navy's global presence. The second reason was put forward by those who did not believe that Fisher was right about the future state of commerce warfare, believing instead that enemy navies would use similar old ships for that purpose, which Fisher disagreed with. The third reason was based around the idea that all of these smaller and older ships would be required for all the various jobs that the Royal Navy would be called upon to do during a war, jobs that were outside of the tasks of confronting the enemy fleet. The fourth reason was probably the most valid, and it was that they believed that the Navy was not planning to build enough small cruisers to replace those that were being removed. Fisher's answer to the third and fourth reasons here were basically that the ships were useless, and useless ships were useless. And so it was better to take that money, the money that was saved, and build a small number of newer and more capable ships, rather than continuing to pour money into the existing fleet. While many naval leaders would argue and raise concerns about the reason for the cuts, the finances of the Navy were greatly improved by these moves. In the 1905 naval estimates, Fisher would cut 3.5 million pounds from the previous year's expenses. The next year, he would drop another 1.5 million, and then a further 450,000 in 1907. In just 3 years, that's a reduction of 5.4 million in the naval estimates, which were only, 36 million in 1904. That's a pretty significant shift. What is that? Over 15% of a reduction. 845,000 of that savings were just from what had been used to repair the older ships, not including provisioning, supplying, or manning them. Scrapping so many older ships also had other advantages. It freed up physical space in Royal Navy harbors, which was becoming a problem. And more importantly for Fisher's plans, it freed up the officers and men to use in the Nucleus Crew system. This change to the budget, this reduction of the budget, would be really important in the years that followed, 1906 and 1907, because that was when the naval arms race with Germany would really start ramping up. And this reduction that happened from 1905 to 1907 gave the Royal Navy a lot of headway or headroom in terms of spending before it started sort of gathering concerns among politicians in London. Along with the changes to the men and the scrapping of old ships, the third set of changes that Fisher would make was around the strategic purpose and positioning of the Royal Navy. These plans were based around the general belief held by Fisher that large, heavily armed battleships would not be the primary focus of navies in the future. This is an odd view to be held by one of the primary people responsible for the introduction of the dreadnought. However, Fisher came to the Admiralty, and when he did, he had a very specific view of what he believed the future of naval warfare looked like, and it was all based around the torpedo. There would be an important moment around the year 1900 or so, when the torpedo would experience some very quick innovations that would greatly extend its range, explosive power, and also consistency. At the same time, the Royal Navy and every navy around the world was still having serious problems extending gun ranges in the same way. The problem was not the guns themselves. They could fire tremendous distances. The problem was hitting anything. This forced large ships to get quite close together, maybe even a few thousand meters apart. And on such short distances, the power of torpedoes were sort of very frightful. The exact advances in torpedo technology and gunnery would continue for the next decade or so. However, when Fisher was formulating his opinions and pushing for reforms, both were very actively changing. This velocity of change meant that naval leaders had not just to work with what was available to them at any given moment, the relative power of a torpedo versus the ability of guns to hit things. They also had to guess how things would develop in the future. To best utilize the power of torpedoes, Fisher was an advocate for a thing called flotilla defense, which was an idea based around the concept that it was better to have a host of smaller destroyers, cruisers, and submarines for the defense of the British home isles. Fisher believed that these types of ships were the ideal type of ship to protect the home islands because they were cheaper and could inflict massive damage on an invading fleet with masses of torpedoes for larger ships and then guns against smaller ships and troop transports. For this sort of denial, the smaller ships would depend on torpedoes, which would make it impossible for the larger, slower battleships to operate in the area. They would just be at too much risk from the torpedoes. Complementing these smaller ships, which would be used to control the North Sea and the surrounding areas, would be small groups of battle cruisers. The goal of the battle cruiser was to combine the big guns of a battleship with the speed and distance or duration or endurance of a cruiser. In ship designs of this period, there was a three-sided triangle of design that revolved around speed, armor, and armament. To greatly increase the speed and armament required the sacrifice of the third side of the triangle, armor. Fisher believed that this was acceptable because these battle cruisers would be larger than anything that matched them in speed, allowing them to use their guns effectively against anything they might come across on the sea. And if there was something that was too big, well, they could just run away because they would be faster. Fisher even proposed ending the construction of dreadnoughts altogether in 1909, and instead focusing strictly on battlecruiser construction from that point forward. The primary purpose of these battlecruisers would be for commerce raiding, or the protection of British commerce. But at the same time that Fisher was pushing for a greater focus on these massively powerful commerce raiders, there was an international development, or set of international development, that made them far less necessary during a war. From the perspective of British trade around the world in, say, 1903, the greatest threat was from other empires that had a global presence from which commerce raiders could base their operations. For example, France had a pretty large worldwide empire, and so they were a major concern when it came to raiding British commerce, because they had a lot of ports that they could take advantage of, that they could coal from, that they could base their ships out of and resupply from. But by 1909, when Fisher was able to really start pushing for battlecruisers, war with France seemed very unlikely. And if Germany was the most likely enemy, its ability to launch a commerce raiding campaign seemed pretty limited. This would prove to be completely correct during the First World War, other than a few commerce raiding actions like the adventures of Admiral Maximilian von Spee or the Emden in the Indian Ocean. There was really not much German commerce raiding happening around the world. But even in the more confined waters of the North Sea, Fisher believed that large battleships were not the answer, because they were too vulnerable, again, to the torpedo. Now, of course, these views of flotilla defense would not go on to completely change the makeup of the Royal Navy. There would still be large ships in Fisher's Navy. The torpedo was just not at a point where it could shoulder the complete burden of naval warfare, and so his views on flotilla defense would not come to pass. Even if he was not allowed, though, to pursue his full vision, he was still kind of subtly nudging things towards his ideas on flotilla defense. For example, in late 1904, he would change the type of destroyers that were being built, and instead of fleet destroyers designed to work with a battle fleet built around large capital ships, he would instead build smaller destroyers with a shorter range that were much cheaper, and so he could build more of them. This would be the first change of a growing number of changes of what types of ship the Royal Navy was building, and by 1909, about 20% of the total construction budget was being used to build the smaller ships that fit Fisher's flotilla defense concept better than the sort of large fleet engagement concepts of earlier years. Fisher also was benefited by the fact that the type of ships he wanted to build for flotilla defense were almost always cheaper, so it was really easy to get political support for the designs. Now, another important part of the flotilla defense concept and Fisher's reforms was the repositioning of the Royal Navy's fleets around the world. The distribution of ships, as it was in 1905, had been determined decades in the past. At that point, decades before, the overall speed of ships had been much lower, and this had required a much wider distribution of the fleet's strength around the globe to be prepared to deal with any problems that might erupt and to protect trade. However, in the age of steam, these same constraints, well, there were constraints, but they were different. Even before Fisher came to power, there had already been discussions taking place about a possible reorganization of these fleets to better account for modern threats and modern capabilities. Fisher would join in these discussions from the Mediterranean, writing to the Admiralty with his ideas of a proper organization, stating that, quote, our fleets should be so grouped and so disposed during peacetime to be ready for instant war. The primary target for these reorganization efforts was the exact size and structure of the Royal Navy ships in home waters, which for many years had been a secondary concern. Until a reorganization in 1902, the primary force in home waters was the Channel Squadron, which usually had some of the latest and most powerful ships in the fleet, but the assumption was that these new ships would have to be dispatched to the Mediterranean during war. This would leave the defense of the home islands to just the ships of the reserve fleet, which was the exact opposite of the latest and most powerful vessels, but instead the older ships that were on the verge of retirement. In 1904, there were 9 main Royal Navy fleets around the world, and part of Fisher's reorganization was to reduce them to 5. When this was combined with the scrapping of all of the older ships, it represented a total redistribution of the Navy's power. The 5 new fleets would be stationed around the 5 key areas, which were defined as, by Fisher, as Singapore, the Cape of Good Hope, Alexandria, Gibraltar, and the Home Islands. The situation for the fleets around the Home Islands very rapidly became confusing, and it all goes back to what exactly made up the Channel Squadron before the reforms. Because up until the point of Fisher's reforms, the Mediterranean was the primary point of Royal Navy strength in the world. It had 12 battleships, while the Channel Fleet, the Channel Squadron, only had 8. Fisher wanted to flip this distribution, with always keeping the strongest ships in home waters. At the same time, Fisher also created his nucleus crew system and a more well-structured reserve, and these were also made into fleets while the transition occurred. This meant that during Fisher's tenure, there were 2 fleets in home waters, the Channel and the Home Fleets. There would also be a major fleet based in Gibraltar, which was designed around the idea of it being like flexible, so it could go to the Mediterranean, it could go to home islands, based on the requirements of the situation. Along with the fleet restructure, there was also a restructuring of the exact responsibility of the commander of the Channel Fleet. Previously, the commander of the Channel Fleet was also required to sort of keep and be responsible for the reserve fleet and the Coast Guard. These responsibilities generally involved a lot of administrative shore work, which resulted in the commander of the Home Fleet spending far less time at sea. These shore-based responsibilities were removed to allow the commander of the Channel Fleet to be a primary seagoing command, much like the commander in the Mediterranean. Now, all of these changes resulted in some confusion, which was kind of inevitable during the reorganization, but was one of the many things that would be used to sort of attack Fisher and his policies by those who disagreed with him. But the most important thing to remember here is what Fisher did is he took 9 fleets, turned them into 5, and made the fleets in the Home Islands the most powerful anywhere in the world. Now, with such wide-ranging reforms, Fisher had many enemies. Part of the problem was that, just like Fisher himself, the oldest and most senior commanders in the Navy had been born in the middle of the 19th century. They had started their careers in the Navy when it was sail-powered, and some of them simply could not adjust to the new reality. In previous centuries, the traditions of the Royal Navy had worked in its favor. By the time of Trafalgar, naval technology had not meaningfully changed in probably centuries, which meant tradition provided experience. However, that tradition was now working against the Navy, and some commanders were simply unable to move forward. This group was not all-encompassing, though. There were many naval leaders who were more than willing and able to jump headfirst into the new technological world. There were some that made good arguments about why certain policies of Fisher's were not correct, or why they should have been handled differently, but there was also a group of officers that simply did not like Fisher and what he was trying to do, so they started to organize against him. And these concerns, these complaints, would eventually lead to a confrontation between Fisher and Lord Charles Beresford, which would eventually see Fisher removed from his position at the Admiralty. But before we get to that story, we have to talk about, the one thing we haven't talked about yet when it comes to Fisher, the introduction of the HMS Dreadnought, which would completely change the landscape of capital ship design forever.